All right, I think we'll get started. I think we're the last few are shuffling in. I'll go ahead and pray, and then we'll get cranking. All right. Father in heaven, we are thankful for another beautiful Sunday and being able to get back into our studies, and we're thankful for this book and thankful for your history and that we can see it through your word and analyze it and understand it and help us to think more on these things and to think about them in ways that will help us as we carry on from here. Bless this day, bless the service, in Jesus' name, amen. All right, so finally, the New Deal. It's the old deal now. It's been been talking about it for so long. So the New Deal. Anybody know what the New Deal is? Anybody want to throw out a? Yes, that is the best one word definition for it. Yes, a lot of different things involved. So it's a very broad, you know, the worst thing that could have happened was we delayed for 2 weeks because I did a lot of reading, and now I can't figure out what to, because there's so much involved. It was funny because, like, what, 4 weeks ago I was saying, we'll just throw the New Deal at the end, and now I'm thinking, I need like 4 weeks to talk about the New Deal. But, yeah, it's really interesting because really, and I'm not a economics expert. But so I'm reading these things, and it's just sort of blowing my mind as I'm really getting into the details of some of the things that happened with the crash and the stock market and what caused these things to happen. And even now, I'm not sure, I'm not going to go into detail because I'm not sure I could give you a great explanation of it all because I'm still trying to work through it in my head. But well, I will give a overview of what happened. And so we talked about before the Roaring Twenties and how it led to the Great Depression. And the, if you Google the Great Depression or what caused the Great Depression, or if you pull, which I did this, I mean, I still have my textbooks from college and from when I went to secular college, I mean, years ago. And so I even looked it up in my American history college book, and same thing. Like the popular explanation is the excesses of capitalism, particularly unregulated big business, led to the stock market crash, which then in turn led to a sizable economic downturn, which then led to skyrocketing unemployment. At the time, the president was Herbert Hoover. He's popularly understood as doing nothing. In fact, it's hilarious because when you read a lot, you know, Wikipedia or whatever, they refer to Hoover as a conservative president. He's not a conservative president. He was a very liberal president. Calvin Coolidge was a very conservative president, but Hoover followed him and did the opposite of what Coolidge did. But in the basic understanding of what happened, Herbert Hoover is characterized as this conservative president that did nothing, and that's what led to the people sort of just rallying behind FDR, and sort of because he was the opposite of Herbert Hoover. And in some ways, there's something to that because Franklin Roosevelt did campaign as the opposite of Herbert Hoover. But really, what FDR did was he even went further to the left of what Herbert Hoover did. So his campaign, and it's interesting too. I wish I could have been there to kind of see. You know, we see our campaigns today and how they're characterized, and then what you actually see. I would have loved to have been around when FDR was campaigning because he characterized himself as a middle ground between Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. In actuality, he was far more progressive than any of those guys. And reading some of the more conservative evaluations of it, they say that you would not have known what FDR really was going to do because he did not really promote his values. And then when he got in office, everything changed. So I'd be curious to actually see how that shook out. But So, but that's the general understanding of what happened. So I'll do a quick closer look at, so the Roaring Twenties, again, the excesses of capitalism, that's not, you know, there's a lot that went on during that time, particularly 23 to 29. Calvin Coolidge was president, very conservative, very non-interventionist president, believed that people can take care of themselves, leave them to their own devices, things will shake out, and they prospered a lot during the 20s. Unfortunately, there were some things where he failed, including his allowing the Federal Reserve to do a few things that they shouldn't have. So during the 20s, though, real income per person rose 2.1% annually. So over that time, the population from 23 to 29 grew from 111 million to 121 million. But despite the fact that this fast growth was occurring, 2.1% of income grew that's quite a bit, especially every year. I mean, we get to the end of it, you're talking about a 10 to 12% increase in income for every, you know, on average for everybody. Manufacturing output rose 23.5% over that period. And then think about, this is the period where electricity was delivered to the masses. This is when electricity came into the home. Electricity comes into the home, and all of a sudden you have people are buying, you know, the invention of vacuums and ovens and refrigerators, radios, radio programming. All of a sudden there's new interest or leisure activities. You know, pro sports becomes a thing. You know, even though there was pro sports before, it was sort of like guys getting together at the park. Now there's a following. It's fandom. People are listening to radio programs. There's you know, movie stars and radio stars and personalities and talk shows. Automobiles during this time, the price of automobiles declined to where it was easy for just about anybody to get an automobile, and that meant that people were traveling all over America. The roadside diner popped up as a thing, you know, where people would go and they would stay in these hotels and motels and go visit other places outside of their, you know, where it used to be before that you grew up in an area and you never left that area. You lived there your whole life. Now people are shuttling all across America and checking out the sites and visiting places and going to sporting events and going to the movies. So it was a very prosperous time. It's not just unfettered capital. I mean, that's the beauty of capitalism right there. I mean, people are inventing things and because they have the money to invent things. Andrew Mellon, the Treasury Secretary, he was a very successful banker. He was tapped to be Coolidge's, actually, I think he was Harding's Treasury Secretary, and Coolidge really liked what he was doing, so he brought him along. And this was his goal. In 1916, America's debt was $1.2 billion. By 1919, it was $25.5 billion after the war. So what Andrew Mellon wanted to do was get rid of that debt. That was his main goal. The way he did it was massive tax cuts. He said, the history of taxation shows that taxes, which are inherently excessive, are just not paid. The high rates inevitably put pressure upon the taxpayer to withdraw his capital from productive business. And Calvin Coolidge said this. He said, government cannot relieve from toil. The normal must take care of themselves. Self-government means self-support. Ultimately, property rights and personal rights are the same thing. History reveals no civilized people among whom there was not a highly educated class and large aggregations of wealth. Large profits means large payrolls. Inspiration has always come from above. And so the idea then is that when the big business, when the people with money are, you know, are not being overly taxed, then they start putting their money into innovative things. During the 20s, it wasn't just unfettered capitalism. It was the fact that all these things were just, money was being put into things to create leisure activities, to create tools in the house that could actually make things easier. We're going to read about later what FDR thought about that stuff. not everything was good, like I mentioned. In 1927, 2 years before the Great Crash, speculative fever was growing. The Federal Reserve had lowered interest rates, and primarily this was simply just to help the Bank of England. So after the war, you know, both England and America were on the gold standard. They got off the gold standard so they could print all this money in order to support the, you know, pay for the war. Well, after the war, they went back on the gold standard and actually said they would not ever get off the gold standard. You know, this was the promise. In fact, it used to be, I didn't know this, but it used to be on the $50 bill, it said on the back, you can take this bill anywhere at any time and redeem it for gold coins. And but unfortunately, England didn't quite recover the way America was recovering. And England was begging that America do something to sort of balance it out. And that's what, so the Federal Reserve, and there's probably a lot more to it. I'm just giving a quick, but so what they did was they created higher inflation in order to sort of balance things. And it ended up leading to the stock market crash of 1929. There's a lot of other things that happened, but I won't waste as much time on that. The Great Depression happened. It begins with the Great Crash. Black Monday and Black Tuesday. On Black Monday, Wall Street lost 13% and then 12% of its value on Tuesday. So it was, I mean, you've heard the stories of the, you know, men jumping out of the high rises, you know, like suicide. I mean, people were just killing themselves because of the anxiety and the depression and everything that was happening. It was crazy. I think even Winston Churchill, you know, this was pre-World War II, you know, but at the time he was visiting New York, and he writes, I think Paul Johnson maybe, I just remember reading this somewhere, where the floor above him, he was standing out looking out the window and saw a guy falling, you know, in front of him, and he writes about that. But so what happened was there was a decline in national productivity, decline in national income, and then followed by widespread unemployment. In 1930, the unemployment rate was 8.9%. 31, it was 16%. 32, it rose up to 23%. And by 33, it was 25%. March of 1933, it was up to 28%. So that's terrible, you know. But the thing is, the U.S. had experienced economic downturns before. And the difference was the recovery rate had been fairly quickly. Most it had taken 2 years to recover, usually about 1 year to recover. The Great Depression was great because it was unmatched in its severity and its duration. And there's a reason for that. Now, before the Great Depression happened, there were warning signs that people did not heed. First of all, in 1925, there had been a real estate bubble that had burst. But people were unfazed. The people that invested into real estate now invested in the stock market. They sort of just took their money, you know, moved it to a new location. Near the end, steel production started again. Eventually things are going to come down. I mean, that's just the nature of bubbles. It's the nature of progress. Steel production started declining. Construction became sluggish. Auto sales started slowing down. Easy credit led to high consumer debt. And then in March of 29, there had been a small crash due to excessive speculation, but it was saved, quote unquote, saved by Charles Mitchell, who was the president of, I think it was called National City Bank, is now called Citibank. But he basically lent $25 million in credit to investors to kind of save it, which all it did was just push it a little bit farther down the road. 1 month before the Great Crash, Irving Fisher, who is regarded as America's first celebrity economist, he happened to also be progressive and a eugenicist, he told investors that stock prices had reached a permanently high plateau. And then the crash happened. bank runs. So if you've seen A Wonderful Life, you know, when people are running the bank to get their money out because the rumors are that the bank is going to fail, those were happening left and right. Thousands of banks went under and went out of business. And this is the thing, I think maybe I heard this before, but this blew me away, is incredibly, despite much of the nation facing hunger and even on the brink of starvation, the federal government deliberately destroyed massive quantities of crops and livestock through FDR's Agricultural Adjustment Act. And the idea was that there were just too many, they weren't making money, so there were too many crops, too many livestock, so they wanted to get rid of them in order to bring the prices down. So what they did is the government went, for instance, they went into Nebraska, bought 470,000 head of cattle, 438,000 pigs, and killed them in order to bring the prices down. Over 6 million hogs were killed nationwide by the government. In the South, 1 million farmers were paid to plow under 10.4 million acres of cotton. And our government still does this, by the way. This is still a thing that happens. The difference today is that we have the Federal Surplus Relief Corporation, so they do give that a lot of that stuff to, you know, relief organizations, and they don't just destroy it, but it's still the same principle is put into place. So, you know, get rid of the, you know, the surplus, because, you know, to drive prices down. or drive prices up, I should say. So while Herbert Hoover is often characterized as a president who did nothing to prevent the Depression, the fact is that while he did keep his, so this is why he's considered conservative. He actually kept the promise in terms of the gold standard. He refused to get off the gold standard because he had made a promise. He was like, this is a promise we made, I'm not going to do it. That's what he's accused of being too conservative. But he hated capitalism, and he was a big proponent of governmental intervention. And so there's two schools of thought about what happened in the Depression. At the time, Herbert Hoover had also carried over Andrew Mellon as his Treasury Secretary. Well, Mellon was around during after the Civil War. The last biggest depression that America had, it was in the 1870s after the Civil War. He remembered this, and he said he remembered that it was painful, that there were a lot of people out of work. There was, it was bad. There was hunger. But it was very short-lived. And because, he said, the collapse was a natural remedy. When the people get an inflation brainstorm, the only way to get it out of their blood is to let it collapse. It will purge the rottenness out of the system. High costs of living and high living will come down. People will work harder. They will live a more moral life. Values will be adjusted, and enterprising people will pick up the wrecks from less competent people. So the idea is that it will just take care of itself. And it did. Like, so after the Civil War, the depression that happened recovered within 2 years. That's what Andrew Mellon said we should do. Okay, the depression happened. It's 1930. What are we going to do? Don't do anything. Let it play out. We'll be fine. Those that are in serious need will, you know, the man, fellow man will help one another. Hoover said, you know, that's very sweet, you know, sounds great. But he said, yeah, but the 1870s, all that suffering didn't need to happen if the government had just intervened. The government is capable of offering relief. And his other argument was, yeah, but back in the 1870s, it was an agricultural culture. Now we're in an industrial culture that you can't apply what happened in the 70s to what's happening now. And so he overturned him. Hoover went the opposite direction. What Hoover did, and this is the first, you know, this is where you can see, you know, like, hey, this is going on today. What Hoover believed in was, you know, we'll just increase wages. That'll solve everything. And that's what he did. He just said, well, we need to just make it where everybody makes more money. You know, abracadabra. And so his economic plan was to increase wages while simultaneously cutting product costs. And he believed that economies prospered when the wage gap decreased. You know, we don't want to have, you know, it's not fair that we have rich people over here. You know, we need to get everybody, you know, the poor and the rich, we need to bring them together and find the common ground. High unemployment rate can be primarily attributed to the fact that companies had to raise wages, which is similar to what we're seeing today with the $15 an hour minimum wage. He then blamed the introduction of technology or as he called it, labor-saving devices for the hard times. So it's just like it'd be like today, you know, like when we talk about the kiosks in the fast food restaurant. Well, that is the problem, you know. We're bringing in these kiosks, and technology is to blame, not the $15 an hour, you know, wage that we're giving people. You know, Hoover's economic solution was like a doctor, you know, where, you know, the best solution is exercise, healthy eating, proper nutrition, and said, no, what we need to do is you need to take this drug here. And the drug at first appears to cure the problem, but ends up the drug is actually causes even more health problems. And in fact, you could say that what Hoover did, even more than FDR, the Great Depression lasted as long as it did because of what Hoover did. FDR, in a way, he's considered a hero because some of the things he did implement actually did help, you know, in the short term. But it's because of, I mean, Hoover took the Depression and made it a Great Depression. So, but let's talk about the New Deal. And eventually, this is supposed to be about the theological interpretation, but there's, like I said, there's just so much. But we're going to get there. The New Deal. FDR actually campaigned against Hoover, I think I already mentioned this, as a middle ground between Coolidge and Hoover. FDR had major support from the mainline denominations. So he adopted the social gospel. He's campaigning. How can I appeal to the people? Social gospel, he adopted it. He adopted the language of the social gospel. And FDR won in a landslide with the support of the mainline denominations who were telling their people to go out and vote for FDR. He won 57% of the popular vote and won 42 of 48 states. So, I mean, it was a massive victory. He rode the wave of support based on his promise to install federal programs that would bring immediate relief, immediate economic recovery, and then long-term reform. And he ensured that if he was able to do this, depressions like this would never happen again. So, you know, feeling new. The New Deal programs. So let's talk about those real quick. So FDR was sworn in March 4th, 1933. On March 5th, FDR declared a national bank holiday, shut down all the banks, and they were not allowed to open until they were inspected and approved of the soundness. And then on March 9th, he began what is called the 100 days, is the record-breaking outpouring of new legislation. So, you know, Biden was just following in the footsteps of FDR with all the, you know, executive, you know, like, nobody had ever seen this before, but of course FDR was able to do what he did because things were so bad. People were ready for somebody to step in and just do whatever it took. So here's just a few of the what the New Deal was. So this was in the first 100 days. Emergency Banking Act, which took America off the gold standard. That's one of the first things FDR did. Let's print money. Civilian Conservation Corps, Federal Emergency Relief Act, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which we already mentioned, Tennessee Valley Authority, Federal Securities Act, National Employment System Act, Homeowners Refinancing Act, National Industrial Recovery Act, the Public Works Administration, the National Recovery Administration. These were all in the first 100 days. After that 100-day period, there were other things like the Securities and Exchange Commission, National Labor Relations Board, Federal Housing Administration, and Social Security Act. Now, I'll just skip through. There's a lot you could say about what FDR did. You know, he did the fire. He was also very endearing to people because of his fireside chats. He was very eloquent. People just gravitated toward him, and I think I even mentioned this a few weeks ago. My very conservative grandmother, she still considered FDR, you know, from her childhood, she remembered FDR was this great president, you know, and because he was very eloquent, because he came across as a, you know, very good person, as somebody that was saving America, and he was doing whatever it took to pull people out of poverty. a few years after he took office, he butted heads with the Supreme Court because of all, you know, what he was doing was unconstitutional. So it's not to say that there were not opponents of FDR out there. In fact, there were quite a few opponents, especially in politics, especially high up in politics, especially in the Supreme Court, which they overturned the National Industrial Recovery Act, saying it was unconstitutional and that it gave the executive branch too much power. And what FDR did in response was, I mean, I'm sure somebody told him, hey, you know, the Constitution does not define the size of the Supreme Court. So one way to get around it is you pack the court. There's nothing to say that you can't expand the court. So that what he threatened to do was we're going to double the court. Right now there's 9 people, or there was 8, and then there was the Chief Justice, and then 8 Supreme Court justices. We're going to expand it to 16, and I'm going to put 8 of my people in there, and then we're going to get done what we need to get done. And he had, at this point, he had Congress and Senate. So everybody, you know, he had the majority. It was kind of a threat because it actually never happened, but it was enough where the Supreme Court actually overturned their decisions and allowed the New Deal, all these New Deal things to pass. So he got what he wanted. So let's talk about the theological influence. There's a lot more, like I said, it's very fascinating. But so the Great Depression, so you have the Great Depression, and then you have, like I've mentioned before, distrust in conservative leadership, you know, what people considered, you know, they blame the capitalists, they blame the conservatives. And that opened the door. Remember, the Roaring Twenties, a lot of the socialists, they were making a run. Remember I mentioned after the war, they were making a run, and all of a sudden people are, oh, I'm making money. You know what? Thanks, but no thanks. And all of a sudden they were just like, oh, well, you know, now they saw their chance. And that's when they started making a push. Progressive theories, programs that have been ignored during the prosperous 20s were not eagerly embraced by citizens and politicians, who are now eagerly embraced by, now. They were willing to do whatever it takes to fix things. So I would say the three things that sort of characterized theological liberalism and this idea of the social gospel and socialism, there was a progressive idealism, so they really believed this. I mean, this is their theology. This is what they worship. This is what they believed was the gospel. So there was an idealism there. There was fear was involved, but then there was also this understanding that, okay, we do want people to get better, but we want to be like Russia. We want communism. We want socialism, and this is how we do it. And so it was political advantage. They understood that the ability to rewrite the whole political, social, and economic structure of the nation, it sort of reminds me of abolitionism in the Civil War, you know, like that was used again. I mean, not to say that they didn't want slaves freed, but they used abolitionism as, you know, it's what we call it today, virtue signal. You know, it's this way of using, you know, getting the emotions of the people in order to get what you want. Well, abolitionism, like, if you know, they made that their big case in order to change things and get what they wanted. Well, this is what's happening now. People are in poverty, people are needy. Let's take advantage of it to get what we want. Abolishment of economic disaster became the new mission. This was the new kingdom of God that they were, you know, when the kingdom goes out, economic disaster will go away. Economic recovery will then lead to economic and social reform. Advocates of the social gospel, amazingly, look to the Russian Revolution and the Soviet communism experiment as a positive example. But they were going to make a few tweaks. You know, I mean, genocide, we don't want that. You know, it's like you can remove the genocide from the communism. So what they said is we don't want, you know, the Lenin and Stalin aspect of, we like communism, we want it here. But what we want is democratic collectivism, and we'll achieve it through legal means through the government and not through violence like Lenin and Stalin. You know, right. Mainline churches influenced a large percent. Okay, I already mentioned this. They influenced the voting bloc. They had control of the theological institutions. Remember last time, Princeton was the last one. They got it in 1929. So they had control of all the major institutions. They had control of the journals. The Christian Century was the big journal at the time. They believed that capitalism was doomed and that Christianity was doomed. So they were not post-mill. Despite even what Singer said, you know. But they believed Christianity was doomed as long as it was aligned with capitalism. So capitalism was evil because it was tearing the church apart, according to them. Paul Banchard, who was editor of the Christian Century in 1932, so during the campaign, FDR's campaign, in fact, those days before the election, he said this. He's in the Christian Century. Socialism was the only solution to the economic crisis which now threatened the nation, and it was an eminently moral solution. It's in, so it would be like the Christianity Today, I guess, if somebody, which wouldn't surprise me to read that in there, but it would be like if the editor of Christianity Today wrote this, the same thing. Socialism is the only solution for the economic crisis. Its end is a society in which every normal human being will share in the world's wealth in proportion to service and ability. So that's what they believe. That's what the churches at the time, that's what the major mainline churches and institutions believed. At the time, there were two major political parties, Democrat, Republican. But the difference was is that both parties had their progressive and their conservative sides. So you had progressive Republicans, progressive Democrats, conservative Republicans, conservative Democrats. It was the theological liberals, the mainline denominations, that actually pushed forward this idea that, you know what, we need to get one party to just focus on progressivism. And that's what happened. It was they focused. And they were big proponents of this. And so the liberals, they came together, the mainline denominations, and they came up with a platform that this is what we want our political representative to stand behind for the church. And here's our platform. And this is not everything, but this is some of the key aspects. Joining the League of Nations, support the Kellogg Peace Act, recognize Soviet Russia. So I guess at the time, even Soviet Russia was not even recognized because, you know, they were doing horrible, wicked things. You know, they were killing their own people. But this is what the church wanted, is they wanted recognition of Soviet Russia, strict enforcement of the 18th Amendment, which was prohibition, federal relief through public works, the use of taxation for the equalization of personal incomes, and the progressive socialization of natural resources and public utilities, nationalization of the entire banking system. So this was the church's platform for what they wanted their political candidate to stand behind. Many progressive politicians, I already mentioned this, FDR, they took the talking points of they realized this. They said, okay, I'm your man. That's what you want. This, I'll be that guy. That's what FDR, his vice president, Henry Wallace. In fact, Henry Wallace said this. He said, they started adopting the language, and he said this: the outstanding uniqueness of Jesus lay in the fact that he enjoyed an unbroken awareness of life in all its vividness. So if you want to be like Jesus, you know, Jesus embraced life to the fullest. This was so real and so thrilling a thing in his life that from the very beginning of his ministry, he worked eagerly to inspire other men to make this joyful discovery for themselves. And to succeed in the search was to enter the kingdom of heaven. This was the method he proposed for the establishment of a lasting happiness among men. And what the point he's getting at is, if you want to be like Jesus, these people out here in the world can't be like Jesus, because they're poor and they don't have the ability to pursue the good life like Jesus did. And so if we want to be like Jesus, we have to step in and make it so that they can do that. And of course, people ate that up, you know. Of course, the social gospel has a distorted view of God's sovereignty and man's sin. and we mentioned this many times, this is not just the social gospel. This goes all the way back to deism and Unitarianism. But it's individual sin can be atoned through education. But the, you know, so it's not even, maybe they call it sin, but it's really reform. Like you're just, you don't have all the facts, and you can be educated toward goodness. But real evil was found in corporations and institutions. And now centralized government was the savior. Along these lines, because the social gospel believed that scripture was fluid and changed meaning as the culture changed, it was no surprise that during this time many believed the same thing about the Constitution. Again, the theology influences the politics. William Key Wallace, who was a pastor and an American delegate to the Paris Peace Conference, said this: "Our American institutions of government give form and substance to the cultural habits of a people concerned with the maintenance of a special brand of liberty, political liberty. The institutions of private ownership once flourished under the system of capitalism, but these institutions of political liberty are no longer pertinent. A new form of liberty is being offered, a liberty undreamed of in the days when our Constitution was framed. We must frame a new constitution if we are to be in a position to afford the guarantees of economic liberty essential to the smooth functioning of a society that has achieved our level of automatic machine power production." So it's a new world. We need a new constitution. This was a pastor. The chief editor of the Christian Century again, the government, he says this: "The government is the people's instrument, and it is the people themselves who regulate it." So then he thinks, "Thus, if all the people were involved in the regulation, the voting, this kind of centralization was not a danger, as all the people were a part of it." So there's just no, you know, if the people are the ones voting for the government to take control, then certainly nothing can go wrong because the people are really in control. FDR said this. He says, "I think that everyone who has actually entered the economic struggle, which means everyone that was not born of safe wealth, knows in his own experience, in his own life, that we now have to apply the earlier concepts of American government to the conditions of today." I need a drink of water. The Declaration of Independence discusses the problems of government in terms of a contract. Perforce, if we should follow the thinking out of which it grew. Under such contract, rulers, so this is his interpretation of the social contract. He says, under this contract, rulers were accorded power, and the people consented to that power on the consideration that they were accorded certain rights. The task of statesmanship has always been the redefining of these rights in terms of a changing and growing social order. New conditions impose new requirements upon government and those who conduct government. Of course, Locke and Jefferson, if they heard that, they would have, you know, pulled their hair out. Their understanding, the Declaration of Independence, was never that our rights come from the government. We had issues with the fact that it was natural rights. You know, they took it. It's interesting. The Puritans, God was their God. You know, and so their religion is Calvinism. Under the social contract, nature is the one that gives rights, and that's how you get Unitarianism and Transcendentalism. Now we're in progressive socialism. Government is the one that bestows rights, and this is how you get atheism. You know, it's an interesting sort of the way these things sort of just shake out through history. But Singer says this. He says, essential to both Locke and Jefferson was the idea that all people by nature had certain inalienable rights and that government was instituted to preserve and protect these rights. And they never would have contemplated the idea that government conferred rights. But it's crazy to think that either Roosevelt is just outright lying because he knows better, or he really did believe that that's his... understood that that's what the Declaration of Independence meant. The final thing I just want to bring up, and we're pretty much out of time, but I do wanted to touch on one thing real quick that Singer brings up. And I don't think he clearly doesn't bring it up because he's not around today to see it, but I do think it's interesting. what was happening during the Great Depression and what Roosevelt was able to do, particularly right away with his Agricultural Adjustment Act, is sort of use fear. You know, he was able to get things done through government because of fear, because people were willing to give him the power to do it. They were fearful. FDR said this. He said, "I tell you frankly that this is a new and untrodden path, but I tell you with equal frankness that an unprecedented condition calls for the trial of new means to rescue agriculture." And so I'm talking specifically about the Agricultural Adjustment Act. But it applies to everything he did. But he says, "If a fair administrative trial is made of it, and it does not produce the hoped-for results, I shall be the first to acknowledge it and advise you." So he's telling, let's give it a shot, and if it doesn't work, I promise I'll admit my mistake. And this is, you know, do you see where I'm going? We see this today. It sounds familiar. Mass mandates, vaccines, emergency measures overriding the Constitution. The Supreme Court back then was trying to stop this. They actually did see this happening. Representative James Beck of Pennsylvania replied to FDR. He said, "I think of all the damnable heresies that have ever been suggested in connection with the Constitution, the doctrine of emergency is the worst. It means that when Congress declares an emergency, that there is no Constitution, and this means death." The bill passed 3-1. So, you know, I just thought that was interesting because here we are again with the government using fear to get things passed, to basically use emergency measure, you know, to install things that, you know, that most people are willing to just go along with because of fear. You could maybe add lack of knowledge, but really it's fear that motivates people to allow the government to just come in and make these changes. So, well, we'll end there. I'm sorry, I kind of packed it full of stuff, and maybe I didn't get as clear on everything, but I think we'll probably just continue to move on, though. But, yeah, if anybody's got questions, feel free. I have extra stuff here, but go and let's have donuts and drinks before service.